Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Good day and welcome to the PageCast podcast. My name is Konita Hunter, and today we are in conversation with my colleague and former co-author, Jeff Wicks, who has written the incredible book, The Shadow State, Why Babita Deokaran Had to Die. Jeff, I am remembering my dining room table, August 2021. It was a whole lifetime ago. And I think it was not long after Babita had been shot and we were discussing it. We were working on a different book project at the time. And you were telling me about this interesting murder that you were interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I remember those days at your dining room table. We were dealing with a completely different calamity and a completely different assault on democracy. And I remember I was slow to start on that investigative project because we were wrapping up our own book. Since I did start that investigation, I haven't stopped. And that's been the last 4 years of my life. And it's interesting how you can sort of plot key events on a timeline. So the 23rd of August, 2021 will always be a date that sticks in my head, and it's a date that's approaching now. And it's particularly hard hitting just because of the cost of who was killed.
So where were you when you found out about this murder, this CFO or this official or this interesting person in the Gauteng department? I mean, at the time there was not, she was not a well-known name.
No, Babita Deokaran was a completely unknown figure. She only became something of a focal point in death. Mm. But at the time that she was murdered, it was a Monday. We were at the newsroom and, you know, I'm a member of News24's investigations team. And I remember that when that shooting occurred, the newsroom tracked it. And that was the team that did the original coverage. But by dint of the person that Babita was, Chief Director of Financial Accounting at the Gauteng Department of Health, and then the manner in which she was killed, which was most obviously a hit, we knew that it was something that we wanted to apply sort of effort and focus to. And
so it was a suburban, it was in a, you know, Joburg suburbs. And tell us about how she was killed.
Yes. So she was shot 12 times as she was pulling her car into her driveway. She lived in Winchester Hills in South Johannesburg. And that Monday had started like any other day for her. She'd taken her daughter to school and she'd gone to Checkers. But unbeknownst to her, she was being followed. And as she arrived home, a car drew up alongside of hers and three men peppered the car with bullets. And she sat bleeding in her car waiting for an ambulance to come. And her family were actually the first to find her. And, you know, it's a typical South African problem where we are inundated with issues of crime and violent attacks and murders. And this case quickly stood apart because of the person that she was and the position that she occupied.
So that comes to my next question, because very soon thereafter, there was these suspicions or concerns around probably the work that she was doing and it being related to her death. How was that? Those dots connected so quickly?
Well, for us, the dots were connected by the politicians early on. At that stage in our lives, we were still in level 3 lockdown of the COVID-19 pandemic, a very different time and space for all of us. And where the Gauteng Health Department was at that stage was in a swirling maelstrom of corruption scandal. Its entire leadership cohort was basically accused of swinging PPE contracts to the politically connected. And there was an SIU investigation, and then Premier David Makura actually fired Bandile Mazuku, his health MEC at the time. And that's what we were in when Babita was murdered. So the politicians, grandstanding as they do, made the connection early on that this was obviously to do with PPE whistleblowing. Those were dots which were impossible to connect. What she actually found was much bigger and much more insidious. And that's what our books sought, that's what my book sought to do, is to tell that story.
Yeah. And so, because the obvious question is, of the dozens of murders that happen, some more ghastly than others, there has to, what set this one apart? That set you on the path of why, because that why becomes what we find out in this book.
Absolutely. I think when I looked at how she was murdered, it was clear to me that it was an assassination. The car was not stolen. None of her possessions were taken. Her cell phone and handbag were still sitting on the passenger seat. when she was shot. No attempt was made to steal from her or to take the car. So that itself told me that this was a hit. And, you know, it's something we see all too often in the South African context, far too often, in fact, officials being targeted because of their stance. So that was a starting point for us. Mm. What added another layer of intrigue and also sort of told us you need to look harder here is because of the corruption that she found at Tembisa Hospital. But at that stage, we didn't know that. All we knew was that the Gauteng Department of Health was a central site of extraction. At that stage, it was for PPE corruption. Mm-hmm. And our thesis when we started investigating it was we need to answer the question, who would want this woman dead? Mm-hmm. And how do we answer that question? And that's where our investigation started.
And then we had those arrests of the Izinkabi, which is essentially gunmen for hire. What made you look at those arrests and say, well, the kingpins are still not in this courtroom?
Well, I mean, we know that Izinkabi are disposable chess pieces in a much bigger game. Mm. They're guns for hire and at a low fee will take life. And when I first saw them in the dock of the Johannesburg Magistrates Court, that was my impression. You know, these are not wealthy men. They've all got ties to the minibus taxi industry. And, you know, that industry itself has a close connection to the world of Izinkabi and targeted killings. But it was clear that there was no mastermind here. And my thesis at that point was to say, well, obviously she was killed for a bigger purpose. But what purpose was that? Mm. And how do we get to that answer? And when it started with Izinkabi, the focus was to say, well, how can we connect these people to potential paymasters? At the time, there was rumors of, you know, high-ranking ANC politicians who were the supposed masterminds of this killing, but we needed to still prove that. Mm. And so that's where I channeled my efforts. And it was a frustrating and daunting pursuit because so little information on these men. Mm. And they were arrested 3 days after the shooting. So that was good work from the cops at that stage. But that's where the investigation died.
Yeah. And do Izinkabi know why they kill the people they kill generally?
Very seldom. You know, the world of organized and targeted assassinations is one with considerable murk. I mean, we have these shooters. They pull triggers for a fee. They don't need to understand why. There's not sort of any moral imperative for them to know that. And these cases, by their very nature, are very complex to investigate because there's always proxies and intermediaries and go-betweens and a considerable amount of shadow work. Mm. And so it's very difficult to get to the paymaster. The obvious conclusion for us was we need to find the motive for this woman's death. Mm. And then began our search because you understand the Gauteng Department of Health is a den of iniquity. Mm. And so are many of the hospitals within the network. So finding a motive for her murder was like looking for a needle in a haystack. Yeah. And it was very frustrating at the beginning.
And I mean, I saw you looking for that needle when we worked together at News 24, where you just would trawl through document after document. But we'll get back to that. I want to talk about the suspicions around it being a political hit. And that came from these guys who were essentially paid to kill Babita. Talk to me a little bit about that and why there isn't sort of a conclusion in that regard.
So the hitmen put forth before court that they had been tortured and coerced into making confessions.
And what was that confession?
That confession was that the lead hitman, Phakamani Hadebe, had met personally with then suspended health minister Zweli Mkhize. Mm. And it was Zweli Mkhize and his brother supposedly that had set this attack in motion. And it was Zweli Mkhize and his brother who'd showed the hitmen to where Babita lived. And they were told that there was a woman who was creating problems at work. Mm. So that is seismic. You know, it's a nuclear development that to have a targeted assassination and now we're looking at a sitting minister as the prime suspect in that. But there were many problems with that narrative. And the dots just simply didn't connect. Just from a logic perspective, you know, even if Zweli Mkhize was a crook and even if he was a murderous crook, which I'm not saying that he is, but he would never be so dumb as to meet with a hitmen front on without proxies or intermediaries in place to give himself daylight. So that story didn't make sense. But that's all we had to go on at the time, was to say, well, all the noise around this murder is that this woman has been taken out for political imperative. Who was the one who ordered the hit? And that was our starting point.
Hmm. And then it changes, your pursuit of the truth and the why changes when you get her devices.
Hmm.
How did that happen?
That was an absolute panacea for us. So, you know, we weren't the only ones on the Babita Deokaran story. So Sunday World, quite early on after her death, reported the substance of a text exchange between her and her boss, CFO Lerato Maggio, where Babita said, "I'm worried that the Tembisa guys are going to be onto us and our lives might be in danger." So I knew from that reportage then that, you know, the answers would lie on her cell phone. And that's what I was really after. And, you know, in pursuing the story, I developed a relationship with her family, because realistically, they were the only ones who could give me answers. The police weren't going to talk to me. And I was intent on getting her cell phone. And the police had seized it on the day of her murder as evidence. So I said to her brother, Rakesh, we need to get these devices because it will give us answers. Either we will find what we're looking for on them, or we'll be able to understand exactly how fast the police are working and if they're working with the level of intent. So I asked him to ask the police for them back. He spun them a yarn about how there were sentimental videos on the cell phone, and the next day we had them. We imaged them. So we got a forensic image of both the cell phone and her laptop. And the laptop gave us a view of 60,000 emails and her email server. And her cell phone gave us a second-by-second overview of the last month of her life. And that was the moment we had paid it, because then we could see exactly what her last investigation was.
And for those, the audience who may not understand investigative journalism quite deeply, there's two situations you don't want to be in as an investigative journalist, where you have too little data or too much data, because both can be awful. And you were in the latter part, where you just had this tranche and tranche and tranche, probably most of it being inconsequential to your probe.
Yeah. I mean, I would much rather be saddled with having too much information than less, because the first months of this investigation were characterized by having next to nothing, and it was very difficult to go on. But once we had the documents, it became unimpeachable evidence that no one could deny. And the challenge there was to sift the wheat from the chaff, because 60,000 emails, as you say, most of them are completely innocuous and benign and have nothing to do with what we're looking at. But it gave us clues. And all it required was one keyword search in that email database, Tembisa, and up popped Babita's report, which she filed on the 4th of August, 2021, just under 3 weeks before she was killed.
And so there is a straight line from that report in her death.
To us, it was too suspicious timing to be any sort of coincidence. The fact remains that it's highly likely that that report, which is 10 pages long, 10 pages likely got Babita Deokaran killed. And the report was brilliant for us because it codified her concerns perfectly. We knew exactly what she was worried about. She was worried about a glut of orders which were being pushed through Tembisa Hospital, this one facility processing thousands upon thousands of transactions, when the other hospitals in the network only moved a handful. And then there was the amount of these contracts going just beneath the 500,000 rand threshold. And that meant that they avoided a rigorous procurement process. Where it was of extra benefit for us was that Babita had actually done the groundwork, and she identified 217 companies which she flagged as possibly fraudulent. So that was her last investigation. She was never able to pursue it further. So we picked up the cudgels there, and that opened up everything for us. That single report ended up being a lodestar, which I'm so grateful for, because it helped us break the back of the story.
Yeah. And then that's when we get this explosion of information of how this hospital is a cesspit of corruption and a feeding trough linked directly to the ANC.
Absolutely. So what it was, Tembisa Hospital had been turned into a contract factory. Their supply chain management office would on a daily basis just approve orders. all just under 500,000 rand in value.
And this is just inflated amounts.
We did price comparisons for some of the medical equipment they were selling. In some cases, 20,000% markup.
Unjustifiable.
Completely.
Beyond the corruption element, just on the pricing.
Well, when we consider that the tender process is meant to ensure value for money, mm-hmm. then it tells you that the whole procurement process had mm-hmm. failed. Mm-hmm. We saw a scenario where the entire value chain was working towards a common goal, and that was to approve these orders. You have SEM officials, you've got compliant nurses and doctors who create a fictitious demand. Mm. It's then shuffled through the procurement process and the hospital manager signs it. And we were able to identify syndicates in this list of companies, because when you look at the list, it's daunting. You know, it's all of these disparate companies. Where are the commonalities? You simply peel back the layer and find out who the director is of those companies, and all of a sudden, the entire landscape shifts. You had one family who controlled 17 entities. It one man who ended up taking control of over 60 companies, doing simultaneous trade every day with the hospital. And then you've got the politically connected actors who had their own fleets and flotillas of companies that were all making money all simultaneously. And that traces back to party officials. Most prominent among them was ANC Ekurhuleni Treasurer General Sello Sokoko. And he remains a political actor today. I mean, he's untainted by this. And, you know, he lost out on a bit of business after we exposed him, but he's now back in trade with the Gauteng Department of Health making money, this time selling toilet paper.
Tell me about some of the other characters that became critical, because one name is now hot in the news, Vusi Musi Cat McClellar. But talk to me about how we get to him.
So we came across him quite early on when we were trying to plot and sketch the size and scope of the syndicates. And he was a relatively small player. He only had three companies that were doing business with Tembisa Hospital, but we were able to locate him as part of a larger syndicate. And that was Morgan Marmela's syndicate. And he's important because he is nephew to President Cyril Ramaphosa from a previous marriage. And he was described by our sources in the health department as being the Don of Tembisa. Morgan is the Don. Nothing moves without him. And we could see it in how much money he was making. Vusi Musi Cat McClellar then was styled as Morgan's consigliere and his muscle.
Meaning if Morgan was the money guy, this was the guy to bring the fear.
Absolutely. Okay. And that's how he was styled, as a dangerous character, as someone who's adjacent to the underworld. Mm. And so he became a point of focus for us. And lo and behold, he has accumulated immense wealth off the back of the public purse, targeting state tenders. And where he became a focal point for us again was, despite being under investigation for procurement fraud from the Hawks and the SIU, he wins a 360 million rand tender from the SAPS, the same organization that is supposedly investigating him.
So and that was external to this Babita Tembisa investigation. You stumble across that Matlala SAPS contract, or is it within the same scope?
No, I mean, it was quite remarkable what he did. He simply formed another company. And it was not an entity that Babita would have been familiar with, because it never traded with the Gauteng Health Department. But it was clean enough that it could bid for and win the SAPS tender, even though it had only been in existence for 5 years. It had never declared annual income over 100,000 rand, and it was run out of a strip mall in Boksburg. So those are red flags which glare on their own. And what he has become is sort of a central actor in the complete unraveling of our security and justice cluster, because now we're looking at everyone he has links to, all the politicians he has ties to, and those names are starting to come out.
But as we see that story play out, I find many common threads. One, the systemic nature of how tender corruption happens, and how corrupt individuals own particular spaces, like you're saying, Maumela was the Don of Tembisa, if you like, and then kind of their networks benefit through, you know, some sort of trough. But then there's always political cover lingering on one side, and shady security cluster links on the other side. So there's this perfect triangle, and you can replicate it in Tembisa, you can take it elsewhere, but that's the modus operandi.
Mm, absolutely. And this the schemes rises or falls on their ability to corrupt the system. And key in corrupting the system is a paper-based procurement system, which when you think about it today, it's 2025.
Mm.
How can it be that South Africa is in a position, a third world country, yes, but an advanced country where we still procure using paper? And that's the genius of this entire thing, and that's how they managed to get it right, because there's so many loopholes in a paper-based procurement system that the checks and balances completely rest on the human element. And that's the one thing that you can never get right, is the frailty of the human condition being able to be bought. And they figured that out and with devastating effect, especially at Tembisa Hospital. We're now looking at in excess of 2.3 billion rand that was extracted from that facility in just 2 years, all through companies which used fake addresses. They existed only on paper. They were printing money.
Is there any accountability there?
Well, we've seen measured accountability. We've seen some of the hitmen who've been convicted and sentenced.
No, I'm saying when it comes to Tembisa itself.
Oh, very little. Some staff members have been allowed to resign. Others have had their pensions frozen. But realistically, when I think people want to hear about accountability, they want to hear about people appearing in court, being convicted and sentenced. And to be honest, there's nothing of that at Tembisa Hospital.
Jeff, this book, Shadow State, is an ode to Babita and her courage and braveness that she had as a whistleblower. She was also a mum. She was a sister, member of the community. And her crime, essentially, quote unquote crime, was that she cared about how money that was meant to help suffering South Africans was being stolen. That's it. And then there's also the story of the perversion of the political environment and how corruption has just become endemic. And anything that goes up against that is fought with the might of 12 bullets.
Hmm.
What are your overall reflections on this 4 years of your life and then writing this book?
I think it's entirely depressing. It's something that I've struggled with, seeing a distinct lack of accountability and trying to understand, you know, did we work for nothing? What did we achieve?
And especially when you read the news and there's, you know, three other whistleblowers killed in Ekurhuleni.
Mm.
And you say that it's that the focus on this doesn't set a precedent or a deterrent in any way.
Mm. I mean, the reality for me at least is that on a daily basis we're confronted with this.
Mm.
Targeted assassinations, eliminating people who either stand up against corruption or who are opposed to it in some way, shape or form. And I think the takeaway for me, especially considering Babita's death, is that, and several deaths since then, assassinations of officials since then, is that people like lawyers and advocates and civil servants and police officers are no longer protected by status. If you stand up against corruption or oppose it or become an obstacle to illicit revenue streams, you stand to be eliminated. It's the easiest course of doing things.
Mm.
You know, when the smear and the compromat doesn't work, then you are taken out. And we saw that with Babita. I think one of the things that I will remember most about writing the book is I feel like when I finished it, I had a much better understanding of who Babita, the human being, was.
Mm.
And it's something that we miss in journalism, is that it ends up being this staccato delivery of fact and connecting the dots and following the money, as
not
people always tell us.
People.
And that was what I wanted to achieve with the book, was to tell her story, because this was a woman who was a dedicated civil servant who actually served and who gave her life in that service, because she felt like corruption and the extraction of money from the Gauteng Health Network was a genocide against patients. And she's right. I think it takes a special type of psychopath to steal from a hospital, and those are the people that she was dealing with. So for me, it was a personal thing.
Mm.
I felt like I knew Babita better after writing the book, and I'm sad that I never got to meet her.
Mm.
I'm also disappointed that, you know, our work didn't yield further results, because people always ask me well, when will you be done? When is the story finished? And it's a question that I ask myself often to say, well, I think we've given Babita Diokaran's family answers, but we can never give them justice.
Of course.
That is outside of our ambit. But I made a promise to them to say that I'll follow the story to the end, and I intend to keep it. Because for as long as I have breath in my chest, I will chase these people and do so with great glee in some cases.
But not without personal suffering. And in fact, talk to me about that cost.
So it's something that I think is seldom seen amongst journalists or people outside journalism, to understand the toll writing a story like this will take on you.
What's that all?
For me, it's changed every aspect of my life. We knew going in that the people who killed Babita would likely kill again if their revenue streams were disrupted, and that's what we were doing. We were going to expose them. And we did it in a fashion that was very public. My name and face were out there. So you understand that you are a potential target. And if we are courting the same danger that Babita did, then when will my bullets come? So it's changed every part of my life. Driving is a paranoid experience for me just by default now. I'm incredibly security conscious. And it took a toll on my marriage because, you know, if I'm facing threats, then my wife faces the same threats. And, you know, it's something that I grappled with. At what point is the story not worth dying for? And it's something that I really had to grapple with, was this is not only my decision to make, because for me, I'm ready to go. If they want to come and take me, they can take me now. I'm comfortable with that eventuality. What's unfair is that my family members may be collateral damage in that process. But I do feel that despite the risk and the long hours and the anxiety and the way it changed everything about the way I live my life, that it was a worthy pursuit and I would do it again.
What happens to the systems that allowed this to happen? How come you don't see any even superficial efforts to say we're going to overhaul things?
I think it's because there is a distinct lack of political will to do so. I think the architecture of the political system relies on patronage, and it relies on state procurement. That is the way the system has evolved and developed into the leviathan that it is today.
And that's what Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi was essentially exposing. And so I don't know if the country would have the enormity of what he was exposing in that famous July 6 press conference had it not been this foundation of reportage that you've done over the course of 4 years to understand how these nexus works and who are these players. And I think that it by you focusing on, for example, Kat Matlala, when it comes out to say, you know, he had this direct line to the Minister of Police, you say to yourself, well, surely this is much more sinister than you could even imagine.
I think what Mkhwanazi's press briefing did was give us perspective. And it's perspective from someone who's an incredibly popular figure, probably the hero that South Africa wants, not necessarily the one that they need. And what he did was make plain capture. He reminded us that capture didn't end when the Guptas left.
Yeah.
And that's something that people forget. And that's something that I was confronted with in pursuing this story, is that capture never left. Capture under the Guptas was wonderfully easy to define. You have perfectly identifiable villains, you know, working at the behest of Jacob Zuma. The real capture happens every day in libraries, municipalities, clinics, hospitals, government buildings, SAS offices. That's where the capture happens, small, innocuous amounts. And it makes you think that, you know, imagine the beautiful country we would live in if every tax rand found its way to its final destination. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. These networks of extraction exist in every facility. We just showed people what was happening in Tembisa. There are other hospitals. They are other organizations. And that's the grand scale capture that we will struggle with until real change is made.
Jeff, what do you hope this book achieves?
I hope that it forces anyone who reads it to acknowledge Babita Deokaran. Mm-hmm. She was, for all intents and purposes, a hero. And that's how I view her. I don't think she ever set out to be a whistleblower. Mm. She was a person uncomfortable with attention and being in the limelight. She was simply there to do her job. Mm. Her job was the numbers. She picked up the anomalies and she did what she was supposed to do. She was abandoned by the system. She was ostensibly left alone to die because she reported her concerns to her boss. Nothing was done.
Yeah.
And it's a real tragedy. And beyond that, beyond the personal loss and the pathos that her family grapple with every day in mourning her loss, it's about saying that this woman sacrificed herself to fix a system. And I was hoping that she would be a catalyst for that. That nothing has changed in 4 years is a very depressing reality to confront.
Hmm. I'm going to mention a few words, and then you just tell me what's the first thing that comes to your mind. And names of people as well. Okay. Morgan Maumela.
He's a big deal. He's made an unfathomable amount of money from government work, specifically at Tembisa and other hospitals. He is a person with immense political and financial reach and someone who should be a focal point of many investigative journalists.
Vusimuzi Katmatlala?
Dangerous man. A figure who shows us that there is a collision point between tender procurement fraud, which is traditionally a white-collar crime, and the criminal underworld. He provides a bridge between those two realms. Mm. And obviously the underworld, that's the shadow state. This is this entire economy that Babita was fighting against.
Phakamani Hadebe?
He's a cold, hard killer. He's someone who was perfectly willing to take money to snuff out a life and then celebrate afterwards.
Ibrahim Kadwa?
Someone who needs to do more and someone who shielded his officers from scrutiny when we could prove that they had botched this investigation.
Hmm. And the SIU?
I have a more sparing view of the SIU, given that they come in only by presidential proclamation, often late. Hmm. And I understand the scope of this investigation. You're looking at between 15 and 20,000 individual transactions. Money laundering, dipping into the sixth and seventh layer. And they have a staff complement of only 700 people. I think Cyril Ramaphosa has given them enough work just in his latest term with all his proclamations. And I think that they are part of a dysfunctional justice system. But they do valuable work, one of the few organizations that does.
The Hawks?
Completely incapable of delivering on their constitutional mandate.
And finally, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when I say Tembisa Hospital?
Babita Deokaran. You know, I've often thought about what her legacy looks like in death. Her family have worked their hardest, and civil society organizations have done the same to keep her memory alive. And I remember at one point someone was floating the idea of renaming Tembisa Hospital to the Babita Deokaran Memorial Hospital. And I thought, oh, not a bad idea. Mm. But then Nisha and Bolton of the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation said, absolutely not. Mm. Clean up that place first. If you name it after her, it will be an affront to her memory. Mm. And that's what the lack of progress, lack of accountability, and a lack of transparency is, really. Mm. It's an affront to her memory. They spit upon her. Mm. And that is the sad thing.
Jeff, after all of this, writing this book and spending all this time, we don't know who is the mastermind. Do you, in your mind, you don't have to say it, are you close in your mind? Can you, if I say the mastermind of Babita Deokaran's assassination, does someone's name come to your mind?
Someone's face comes to my mind. I have a very good idea of who it might be. But again, I'm a mere journalist. That's for the police and the prosecuting authority to chase down. I have a good idea of who would have had a very strong motive to eliminate her and who would have had the means to do so as well.
And I think the next time that me and you sit down, we'll probably be talking about that person.
Let's hope.
Jeff, from my side, I've worked alongside you for many years. We've done many a stakeout together in our lives. We've been through many a stolen document. Stolen, quote unquote. But to say, it takes a huge amount of grit, and I don't even think grit is an adequate word to do what you do. Many of our colleagues abandon this type of work just for the personal toll that it takes. So much of this industry is thankless, and if not thankless, it's also, you know, suicidal in many ways, because you're putting yourself in front of harm's way in such a direct way. But the country owes you an enormous amount of gratitude, because had it not been those hours and hours and hours of director searches of every single one of those, what was it, 217
companies.
17 companies, we would have not understood what this cesspit of corruption takes and how this feeding happens. And as I read this book, I kept thinking of every single entity that I've reported on or read about where corruption happens. And it's Tembisa Hospital, but take this and multiply it across the whole Gauteng Health Department. Step out of that to the National Health Department. Step out of that to every single government department, and then work your way all the way down to some municipality called Maluti Apofong or some random municipal water board. And it sends shivers down my back to understand that there is nothing but a treasonous agenda to loot this country until there's nothing left to loot.
I absolutely agree. I think what we see on a daily basis, whether it's looting from Eskom or looting from the health department or through other flagpole or soccer sponsorship tenders, is greed. It's untrammeled and unbridled greed. And when you think about the amounts which were extracted, it's figures that you and I could never experience in our lifetime, you know. But it's very kind of you to say thank you. It's, as you mentioned, it is thankless work, but it's work that I will do willingly. It bothers me. It bothers me that people can profiteer off an industry of death. Not only Babita's death, but all of the patients who go to Tembisa Hospital looking for care and who die in the hallways, sleeping on the floor. It's murderous. And it is an outright attack on democracy. And that's the point of what we do. And that's why I'll continue to do it. Because I cannot abide by people stealing and there being a distinct lack of accountability across so many spheres. At least let me name them. At least let me tell people where the money went, and then they can decide whether or not they want to join the dots or rise up or mobilize. That's for them to do. I only tell you where to look. And, you know, it's a job that comes with immense responsibility. You know, every facet of it is born in conflict, whether you're dealing with attorneys or threats or social media derision or death threats. It's entirely based in conflict, but it's something that we cannot not do.
Jeff Wicks, congratulations. This is an incredible endeavor. This is a great book to read. The Shadow State, Why Babita Deokaran Had to Die, out in bookstores now. You will not regret it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.